Welcome to the Baseball America Podcast. Baseball America, bringing you baseball news you can't get anywhere else for more than 35 years. Now it's time to talk baseball.
Thank you, Dave Slade. I know it's been a long time since we've podcasted at Baseball America. It's the end of June. We've realized, JJ, we just needed to go ahead and squeeze in a podcast before June ended, because why the hell not? What else we got doing? We're sitting here waiting for Kyle Arnold series copy. Josh Norris also joining us, so you might get to see the JJ and the Bear GIF. Probably my favorite GIF in Baseball America history.
It's a GIF to me.
It's GIF.
I like it. I love the JJ and the Bear GIF, and you guys haven't podcasted together in a while, so I'm bringing you guys together here.
Yeah.
It must have been your mutual hatred of each other that kept you apart from each other.
He is my sworn rival.
I'm about to say, I'll tell you what we all hate, though. There are a lot of hot-button topics. The end of June, this has just been a freaking crazy month. I mean, like, we're all a little frazzled, but this has been even bigger than usual. We've got a major league game down the road coming up, and we don't even know how we're going to go. Like, we got to be there for 12 hours for this major league game in Fort Bragg. We got draft signings, Fast and Furious, College Series that took forever, finally ended. And now we have this lawsuit, guys. We've had this lawsuit.
We've been writing about this for literally, I can say literally because I looked it up, at least 6 years.
But Major League Baseball dipping its toe in today. And Minor League Baseball has had its say. But I guess, Josh, you're the one who's written the most about it. But I'll try to sum up to tee you up on this. Essentially, Minor League Baseball is resisting this lawsuit to try to pay minor league players a little bit more of a living wage. And the minor league lawsuit, would radically change the way minor leaguers are paid, because it would pay them a minimum wage, which isn't a living wage. You're right, JJ. Good point. But Minor League Baseball resisting any calls to pay minor league players more, and Major League Baseball dipping its toe in today, basically talking about how much it subsidizes minor league baseball and how this whole system would fall apart if minor leaguers were played more. You had this bill introduced in Congress called the Save America's Pastime Act.
That one of the two sponsors has already backed out of.
Right, it was bipartisan sponsorship. Now the Democratic sponsor has backed out.
The Democratic sponsor, who her father was MLB's first lobbyist and who took money from the MLB commissioner's office, that's the one who has backed out. Brett Guthrie of Kentucky, the Republican from Kentucky, is still involved. And MLB issued its statement today in full support of it. Shocking, absolutely no one.
Right.
It's the crux of what they're arguing is that MILB players are exempt from the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938.
Right. Basically, it says they're seasonal workers, right?
That's what I was getting to. Yep. Yes, it says they're seasonal workers. This is a short
seasonal apprentice.
Apprentices, right. And they later in the statement, they say they're much like musicians or artists who are not covered by the FLSA.
This is exactly the argument that we heard Stan Brand make. First, when he sounded the alarm at the winter meetings in 2014, and then you and I sat there and heard him, the speech he gave at the winter meetings in Nashville this year, 2015. Stan Brand, longtime lobbyist in Washington, D.C., who's been the lobbyist, basically, on Capitol Hill for minor league baseball for 25 years, if not longer. He's a power player up there. He knows everybody. He knows congressmen. He can get meetings, and he clearly got what he wanted in this bill. Now, whether the bill passes or not, you know, is a whole other matter. But he got what minor league baseball wanted. Right. He got what he wanted in this bill, in the makeup of the bill. I mean, this is not to be too cynical or too political, JJ, but this is kind of how the sausage gets made these days, is the lobbyists often write the bill. That's what it sounds like with this bill.
Well, it is unusual that a sponsor of a bill would less than 24 hours later essentially say, whoa, I'm not touching this bill. I thank you for your feedback. I'm not supporting it anymore. That was not someone who said they were going to support the bill. That was one of the two co-sponsors of the bill.
This is Sherry Bustos, who sounds suspiciously Greek.
And even more shockingly, she, in her statement, said she backed out after she did more research on the topic, which you might want to go ahead and know your topic before you author it.
Know your beat. Hashtag know your beat.
But really what it comes down to me is that MLB has an argument here, which is a pretty limited one, but the way I guess the world is now is you don't make the argument based on that very, very limited argument. You try to use very alarmist language.
Yes.
In the release that they had today, MLB said, look, we spend over $500 million in bonuses and salaries for players every year, if minor league baseball had to pay for this, then it would, you know, minor league baseball would fold essentially, which is completely true, but is also something that no one has in any way proposed that minor league baseball teams are going to have to start paying for the bonuses of the first round picks. The reality is that when you say half a billion, well, we know where 230, 240 million of that is draft bonuses.
And if you bought it through the international, then you're going to get closer to that quarter of a billion like you're talking
about. What you're talking about is the majority of that money is bonuses, which, yes, if you were a first-round pick, the reality is that this is not this whole deal is not something that is particularly germane to you. Because,
or a second-round pick these days. I mean, those second-round picks are getting, they're going to be, what, 65, 70 players with $1 million bonuses?
Right, but... So if you're getting $1 million as your bonus, the reality of this is that then making $1,150 a month in rookie ball or whatever, which is roughly the right number.
I had an agent tweet at me when I tweeted this out. He has clients making $3,000 this year, period.
For the year.
Because if you only get paid.
You only get paid in regular season from opening day to closing day. Not spring training, not instructional league. There might be a stipend for the fall league.
That's what I thought. I thought the fall league was a stipend, but we have to research that.
Isn't that also true though for MLB players? Or they can have their contracts structured so they get regular pay. But I think they also.
Let's be honest.
Matter.
It doesn't matter when you're making $500,000.
When the minimum is
right.
Yeah, but so the thing about this is that if you get those bonuses, then yeah, it's no big deal. But that is the minority of players. It's the minority of international players. It's the minority of draft picks. The majority of draft picks, every team drafts 40 players. So we start from there. More than basically 3 out of every 4 of those 40 draft picks, and admittedly not every team, most teams don't sign all 40, but let's just make it simple. 75% of those players drafted are getting signing bonuses of $100,000 or less.
Yes. And we even had, Jesse Schultens of Wright State this year, a good college pitcher, a senior. You know, some of these college seniors are signing for $5,000, $7,500, $10,000.
In the top 10 rounds.
Schultens signed for $1,000. I mean,
that's a flight.
That was surprising.
So,
a round trip flight.
Because he's paying tax on it.
Yeah.
So, but the reality of it is that you are talking about, for the majority of these players, they are not getting a bonus that says, okay, I can live off that bonus while I undergo, quote, this apprenticeship. For the majority of these players, it is something where what you get to is by the time you are in year 4 or so, and you have to a lot of times make an assessment, not that I'm not going to make the big leagues, but if I have a very small shot of making it to the big leagues, do I need to quit?
Right.
Because if I don't, I basically have borrowed from my parents, or I can't get a good enough winter job to subsidize my summer. I'm tired of basically sharing a room with 3 other roommates.
Yeah, exactly. There's only so many lessons I spent time in the day for me to give personal hitting lessons.
Right.
And Mike Miller, who was called up by the Red Sox yesterday, said to one of the Boston reporters that in 5 years in the minor leagues, he's made $40,000.
Right.
That's absurd.
Well, that's reality.
Normal. I mean,
that
it's reality, but it's
very normal. The problem is, to me, is that minor league baseball is such a different enterprise. What other industry are there really where basically 80 to 90% of the players involved are there just to be competition for the top 10%? It's such a unique enterprise. I understand why one would argue that they don't fall under this the FLSA, but the thing about the fundamental what you said, JJ, about the alarmist language is why Major League Baseball is never going to win this in a court of public opinion. First of all, it's Fair Labor Standards Act. That is something that everyone should be able to get behind. This was passed in 1938, Depression era. It should be easy to want to have fair labor standards. B, you have Major League Baseball with this Saving America's Pastime
In that release yesterday, they said, basically without this, you could see teams like the Louisville Bats or the Bowling Green Hot Rods or teams go away, which, again, that is alarmist language, because the reality of it is that, no, I mean, that's the after effects of this, if this happened, is not going to be, the Louisville Bats, who who draw this significant amount of fans every year in a very nice stadium that draws good revenue. I promise you this. If minor league baseball completely ceased to exist tomorrow, you can't tell me that there would not be an independent league team at the least in there.
Exactly.
Which by the way, independent league teams are not paid. They pay their salaries themselves. The argument you can make, and I think again that Major League Baseball, but they are going, they have this smidgen of an argument, and then they're trying to make it into something that's this monolith of an argument.
Right.
Is that okay? If this doesn't happen, could it kill independent baseball? Absolutely. If that independent baseball, which again, there's no reason that if you're talking about that minor league players need to be paid a much significantly higher wage to make sure that they're paying at least minimum wage, and they're having to paid, again, I think there are some hourly constructing how many hours that is that you're paying them is very difficult. But if you did work that all out, and you said that that's true for affiliated minor league baseball, well, logically, it also applies to independent baseball. And in independent baseball, if you did, legitimately, if you said, we're going to go from this guy makes $1,000 a month to he has to make $3,000 a month, well, you'd have very few independent leagues left.
That could really hurt any ball. But the last paragraph, and I think you wanted to say something, Josh. I don't mean to let me know. You can interrupt me.
I had said that you guys were talking about, you know, it was something that the FLSA was something everyone could get behind. I had multiple people in my Twitter feed yesterday saying, you know, I'm a Republican, but I'm for this, or I'm for this, that, and the other thing. I fall this way as my political beliefs, but this is an exception to that rule.
I really do think the reason is because of what JJ said, because of the overblown language. So this last paragraph of MLB's statement, minor league baseball players always have been salaried employees similar to artists, musicians, and other creative professionals who are exempt from the Fair Labor Standards Act. You can make that argument. It would be easy to make that argument if you had, you know, raised minor leaguers per diem to keep up with the cost of living, or raised some of these minor league salaries over the years as the industry went from a $2 billion industry 20 years ago when I started here to $9 billion now. But all that $9 billion, those revenues have all gone to, just like everything else in American society, the top, the owners and the players, not to the rank and file. It's under that top 1% in the industry.
Now, my proposal.
Oh, but these are the same owners who are successfully taking away health care and insurance benefits from scouts and non-uniform personnel. They're taking away their benefits. They're taking away their pension plans. That used to be one of the great benefits of working for a Major League Baseball organization. If you were not a player, you got pensions. And these things are being taken away from scouts by a lot of these clubs. Why? Because they can. Because they do that in their other businesses that made them billionaires to buy these major league franchises. If they could have saved themselves just by raising some of these salaries. But this other sentence, like other professionals, it's simply impractical to treat professional athletes as hourly employees whose pay may be, that may be true.
Right.
Whose
again,
pay, but here's where they lose people. Whose pay may be determined by such things as how long their games last, when they choose to arrive at the ballpark, how much they practice or condition to stay in shape, and how many promotional or charitable appearances they make. I mean, that is, I have to stop laughing to read that sentence. That's unbelievable. To go from like a reasonable position and a reasonable, I think, winnable argument, and then to finish with, hey, we're not paying these guys extra for charitable contributions they're making that builds our brands, not theirs.
To me, though, I do have a solution for this, which will not happen. But
my
logical solution for this is, okay, which we just talked about, there are $240 million a year going towards signing bonuses for draftees.
Yes.
And if you said, we're going to take that, this requires both sides who, the reality is, the reason all this is happening is that there is no union at the minor league level.
Correct.
And they're almost assuredly.
Thank you, the winner, right?
There almost assuredly never will be one. There never will be.
This was a story I started on before I got to BA, and then
There will never be a minor league union, because the reality of it is that the players who would try to form a minor league union, the cost benefit ratio for them is so dramatically averse to the benefits for the cost.
It also would be like the NFL quarterbacks club. The guys who are like the quarterbacks, the top prospects, those guys would have their own union.
Right.
Separate from, they would be the major league union, not the minor league union. It really, it would be like that.
But what you could do, though, that MLB and MLBPA could do here is, and it would require them to get together and agree on this, but, okay, because they just said Major League Baseball does $500 million. That money right now is done in a way. If you said, okay, draft bonuses internationally, we're going to cut it. Because they now have strict caps.
Absolutely.
This is not something you could have done 10 years ago.
Correct.
Because 10 years ago. But nowadays, when you say, we know how much we're going to spend in the draft. We know. And we're going to take, let's say, what would it take? $50 million? $50 million from that. And we'll take $50 million from that. And we can take $50 million. And again, I'm doing the math off the top of my head.
Well, so
it may be less than that.
So they're roughly 25 players per team in the minor leagues. And they're how many teams? 160?
180.
Let's just work with the four
no,
full seasons.
No, we don't work with all of them.
That's,
you got to work with all of them. There's a, you got a DSL.
That's 4,000 players.
So, but if you said...
Roughly.
Because again, because the short season guys and all, and the DSL guys and all, are the guys who are in the, usually in the worst shape financially with this. But if you said... that owners kick in without, you know, they have to do that without basically just slashing everyone else, you know. Hey, all of a sudden we're cutting everyone else in our staff. But if both sides would kick in a little bit of money from percentage-wise of the $9 billion, it would not take much. But that's not what's going to happen.
Right. Yeah, because if you just have 4,000 players, roughly, and you wanted to pay them $10,000 a year... as a minor league salary, roughly. That was the average. That's a lot of zeros. You know, that's a lot of money. I can't even count the zeros. 1, 2, 3. I'm so bad at that. That's 7 zeros. It's $40
million. It's $40
million. That's a lot of salary.
Who's, but, right. Well,
who's gonna, a little less.
Where's that going to come from?
Well, when you say that, though,
I'm just saying, who's going to get that up?
When you say that, I just summed it up. Like, if you could literally, if you said that we're going to cut, next year's draft bonuses will go down instead of up. And so we're going to cut 25 mil from there. But then at the same time, MLB has to take 25 mil from, you know, their shared revenue from, you know, BAM. And they have to kick in $25 million each year.
I mean, if you $10,000 isn't even that much, but $10,000 would be a raise for most of those players.
But if you did $25 million each, which again, that would mean that draft bonuses would go from 230 to 205.
You're still taking money away from that pool of players, basically.
Yes.
Why would you even want to reduce bonuses? Why not just ask the Major League Players Association and Major League Baseball? To just, and the owners, $50 million each, $100 million like an escrow, like every year out of this $9 billion revenue pot that goes to minor league, that goes to raise standards for minor leaguers.
The reason I say that is because they would say, where is that coming from? You have to say it from somewhere. When you say, take that money from that revenue, where is that
coming
from?
We're going to cut taxes, JJ.
But if you said this, because really all you're doing then is you are essentially... What you would be doing is you would be cutting the bonuses a little bit, but you would also be cutting it from, you'd be going from both sides. It'd be coming out of those players,
right.
And it'd be coming out of,
I'm not for cutting bonuses either, signing bonuses, because most of these players, none of these guys are on full rides in college anyway. A. B. Who knows how much money all these guys spent to go to all these showcases to get drafted. I mean, I'm
too
just,
much.
Too much. But like you just said, Josh, $50 million. Is almost basically is like two Yankee players on the some teams might spend on the disabled list in a year.
What the Dodgers are always spending on the pitching staff on the disabled list right now.
Yeah, or on Cubans.
Well,
so
yeah,
Clayton
Kershaw went on today. So.
It does feel like it's doable, and this was avoidable. A lawsuit was avoidable. This bill could have been avoided if Major League Baseball had just treated minor league players a little more humanely. In the last 20 years.
Because again,
he said it earlier. Everything's gone up except their salaries, or except minor leaguers' salaries.
And their per diems.
Their per diems.
Because don't forget it was...
Their per diems have gone up. They've gone up slightly.
When?
4 years ago.
Was that the $20 to $25? Because yep. Even that was a joke. It was the first time it had gone up in, what, 40 years? And it went up $5? So now you could throw in a chalupa Taco Bell?
Yeah, and it's not like the spreads in minor league baseball are free, too. You have to pay the clubby.
Right, exactly. So
there are dues. Yes, there are dues. I mean, the reality is that The thing that I don't understand with this in any way is there is this belief, because we've heard it, is that this is the price you pay, which does prove whether you're willing to pay the price to become a big leaguer. That there is this belief in some ways that that means that when you get to the big leagues, where
leaguers are so entitled, JJ, is that what you're saying?
But when you get to the big leagues, we've heard, you know, I'm sure y'all have heard the argument, is when you get to the big leagues, then that's the payoff. Well, but what it does do is it eliminates players, because even if they could get the payoff, if there was at least still a chance, they weren't a top prospect, but they had a chance. They, at some point, a lot of these guys say, I can't do this anymore.
Right.
I mean, the funny thing is this, we know Garrett Brocious, who is the guy who's leading, spearheading, now as a lawyer, is spearheading this lawsuit. We know him because he used to write for us when he was in the minors.
Right.
And I remember talking to him as he had to weigh this back and forth. This is a guy who had some success in the minors at times, but the reality of it is that he got to a point, he's like, he was an adult. When they talk about these seasonal apprenticeships, it makes it sound like, I mean, it's one thing if to say is okay, you're a short season player as an 18-year-old. There is one thing about that. Like, that is a, hey, I went from playing for travel ball to I'm now playing for a big league club's, you know, rookie ball team.
Right.
There's a difference between that and the 25-year-old who's in Double A, who's married, and basically, if he's married to a spouse, you know, who does not make significant money,
right?
There's no way to really make it work. Or you just say, I'll see you in 9 months. Because the reality of it is that, as he's written about at BaseballAmerica.com years ago, you have situations where you have families where you have a couple who is sharing their room with two other, you know, an air mattress. They got an air mattress on the floor, and there's two other players in the room because that's the only way that everyone can make it work.
I mean, the reality is you're going to have guys who did get the big bonuses who are sometimes in these rooms. You have a guy who could be a future star tomorrow who's sleeping on an air mattress today.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense? If MLB cared at all,
it's not that they, it's not about the caring. It's about
what they can get away with.
It's what they can get away with. And the reality of it is that
It is about big business, and it's about wages, and American wage growth across the spectrum of the country is flat. So why would we expect minor league baseball to be any different?
But it's not. But the reality is that doesn't really work either, because the reality is that when you say it's flat, in minor league baseball, it's not flat. It's actually, if you crazy
in the
cost
minors,
of living, it goes on a downward slope.
Which is the same, though, for the American family.
Right, but the reality is...
More dramatic in the minor leagues.
Much more dramatic.
But it's the same principle, though.
But the
people who control the purse strings are the same in a lot of the...
But I'm
trying
to... They
run in the same circles.
But what I'm saying, though, is that if you look at this, the way I can best personalize it is, okay, imagine that you are a college senior, we just talked about, a college senior who loves the game.
Ten years ago, when you were in college, when you first got out of college, you could afford to buy 10 boxes of Kraft mac and cheese, but now you only get 5. That's what these guys are doing.
Okay, but let me roll on this, which is that when you take a senior, like a Jet, you know, who pitched well,
Jesse Schultens,
who got no bonus essentially. Now, you are a college senior. You just graduated for your degree. And so your choice is that you can go for your dream, which, admittedly, there's a huge payoff. If you can just make the majors for 1 year, all of this is worth it. Let's just be honest. It's $500,000 minimum. $500,000 is better than you're going to probably do in any career you...
Pays you back for, like, all the rest of it. Like, Cody Decker talked about it last year when he got to the big league for those 2 weeks. We've talked about that for so many players. When they just get called up for those September call-ups at the end of those long careers, Dustin Mulliken, it doesn't make up for all of it because Dustin Mulliken was 13 stinking years in the minor leagues.
But a long apprenticeship.
But it helps,
man.
Exactly.
But if you take that away, though, and you're making the minors, imagine if you're listening to this and I told you, you have to figure out, okay, so you're going to live and you're going to make, let's say it's $1,200 starting out, $1,200 a month. And by the way, do remember, this is most places. I know there are places that are host families. A lot of places.
Not all.
A lot of places you don't.
You're living in an apartment. You're
paying
rent.
Okay, so you're living in an apartment. You're paying rent. you know, hopefully it's furnished because you're moving around. I mean, you're the reality of this. And then it's also, it is one, when they talk about this apprenticeship, this is something that prevents you. If you're going to do this at all well, it prevents you. You can't, this is not the 1950s when baseball players would sell insurance in the off season.
Right.
This is a year-round job.
But again, they do make money in those off season. Right. But it's usually training.
Right.
Training,
but most of, but a lot of them work at Home Depot or
right.
wherever.
Absolutely.
And
remember
and,
the story about the Lorenzo Barcelo who'd been in the big leagues and was working at a Home Depot in Tucson when he decided to give it one more shot. When pitched in Mexico and went up getting to the big leagues at the end of that year with the Dodgers after pitching well in the Mexican League.
Chris Martin was working at Lowe's when he got, but someone, oh, he got a really good can stacking arm. He's got big velo there.
But the point is, yes, their wages haven't gone up and it's harder for them to stretch these dollars. And it's very difficult to justify how little they're paid. And it's very difficult to, I mean, like you could make logical arguments and legal arguments for what Major League Baseball's done, but they're not going to win any fans with the way they're treating these minor league players.
As you just summed it up, I mean, again, and if the reality is that it's all about leverage and all that, this is why Cuban players who are free agents get a lot more money than your draftees and all that. But you just summed it up. You said, okay, so there's, you summed up the players. You said, hey, that's, I think your number was that you figured up was that'd be like $40 million.
$40 to $50 million.
Right.
Your rough total was a good guess.
Or that's $40 million. Yoan Moncada, acquire Yoan Moncada, the Red Sox cut a check right there for $63 million. Now, again, these are apples and oranges in some ways because that's the price to get, but it does remind us. Let's go. Yoan Moncada is a really good prospect. Look how much Yoan Lopez or Roberto Valdequin.
Major League Baseball will pay for elite talent, and they don't want to pay for the guys who play with that elite talent. That's really what it boils down to. I don't even know how else to put it. Now, speaking of large amounts of money changing the game, we just saw the end of the College World Series. We might wrap up with this point. You guys aren't huge college baseball fans. You watch some college baseball. JJ, I know you watch a lot more the last 2 years than you ever did before.
No. I used to watch every game of it because remember, I was doing the web. So I watched every game. I'm sitting down. We'd wait for you guys to file.
You didn't wait as long as you did, as we are now.
Yeah.
I promise that.
No, we were up at 2 in the morning because it'd be rain delays. One year it rained every game, I feel like.
2010. That was a bad rain year.
Yeah.
What's your guys' impression? I mean, Josh, what's your impression of the College World Series? You've been watching just the last couple of innings of the finals together as a #BA family. I mean, the last couple of innings were pretty thrilling. What's your College World Series impression? A takeaway as somebody who's not a huge college baseball fan.
I mean, we all know that I backed the Pack, and I wanted Zona to win. But you know what? Coastal Carolina, that's a great
back to
story.
The Pack? I thought you backed the Ducks.
You backed the Pack when the Ducks are out.
Which Pack? Oh, the Pac-12. Okay.
Yeah, not the Wolf Pack or anything like that.
No, that's what was in mind.
No, you're back to Pack. But either way, I mean, you take that, you remove that little element there, and Coastal Carolina winning is awesome. You know, it was a long, arduous College World Series, not so much for me because I'm not there, but just to see the look on Gary Gilmore's face after the final out was made, that was priceless.
And Coastal Carolina, the analogs that people keep coming up with in college sports, JJ bristled at when Will Lingo came up with BYU in Division I football in 84, winning the Holiday Bowl.
Well, my problem with that is that this was a game decided on the field. This was not someone winning a mythical national championship by playing a game that against an unranked
Michigan
team
yeah.
on like 10 days before the games that were supposed to matter, and then at the end of it going, none of these teams really are that impressive. Let's give it to them. This is actually two teams on the field deciding something. They actually win a national championship. We have just started having football national championships in the last few years. Before that it was just like whoever.
The only analog you could really think of was like if Butler had beaten Duke or UConn, but
right.
they didn't.
And you know it's almost imperfect too because Arizona wasn't Duke. I mean, Duke was
correct.
Arizona
was more like UConn.
Butler?
No, they were kind of like UConn because a power school with tradition. That had a bad team by its standards, but almost won a championship. I mean, like, Kemba Walker carried that UConn team. That wasn't a great UConn team.
And Arizona was picked, I think, ninth in the Pac-12 in preseason?
That's correct.
And
almost won its fifth national championship. The finals were compelling. Game two was really sloppy. Game three, clearly, big error by Cody Raymer, second base for Arizona. G.K. Young with a big two-run home run for Coastal, which almost coughed it up. Alex Cunningham did not have many bullets left in the arm, and Arizona with a gallant comeback in the ninth, got a run, second and third. Great play by Marks in left field for Coastal Carolina on the double.
That won't show up in the box score.
Yeah, I mean, that was. But all that said, Colville series, I don't know if I'd say it's broken. It definitely seems flawed right now. Well, guys, it just doesn't generate buzz.
No,
like
I don't. I wouldn't say that. I think that is that
we're baseball. We're deep in baseball. No, generates that, but the ratings are down. There's just not. Do you know casual fans who are interested? Casual baseball fans.
Again, a couple things. One, putting the game on today during the day was, as I said at the time, I mean, it was a very bad decision because
you lost. That's one out of 17 games. The whole series before that was iffy. They had a game with less than 10,000 people. That hadn't happened in years in Omaha. But go ahead on the game.
But the problem is that they built a broken stadium.
They built the bad
stadium and pointed it the wrong way.
Right. With those bats and pointing it that way. But they had no idea the bats were going to take away 50% of the offense when they built the stadium. If they had the old bats, you'd have a decent amount of offense. You would have the offense you had in the old park. But I mean,
you'd have a lot more offense. But when you say that, though,
50% of the offense were out of the game, JJ.
I know, but the thing about it is that the game until it goes to Omaha is a good game right now.
It's a better game. It's a better game than it was with the old bats in terms of like
it's a balanced game.
It's a more balanced game. I wouldn't say it's a better game because the talent in college baseball seems to be down. I just was DMing with a scout just now talking about it. About the just utter lack of athleticism in college baseball is really disconcerting for a lot of veteran scouts. And this was a bad year in college baseball. Last year was better from a draft talent standpoint, but I think it's the general consensus.
I feel like that's a little bit in that.
I think it's worse now.
I think you and
last 6 years or so, I would definitely say the talent is down from what it was. Say 10 years ago in college baseball, for sure.
I'm not saying it wouldn't be down a little bit. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So even you and Brandon McCarthy and a couple other guys were having this conversation on Twitter the other night just about the product in general, whether it's the talent, just the way the game is played and micromanaged.
It's always been micromanaged. I think it's noticed more by people now because all college sports are micromanaged. That was my point. But I do think the bat change really exposed, this is what I wrote in my column, I shortened it, but it really exposed the poor offensive approach of amateur hitters in general who used to get away with it with the old bats. You can't get away with it anymore. Bad approaches equals panicked coaches who bunt more than they would bunt, who try to force the action more than they would force the action. And it just produces a very different game. It is a more balanced game, JJ. There's no doubt. But it's not a better game than it was because the talent was better. You're the one who talked about the signings and how many fewer guys go unsigned. That's a lot less talent in college baseball, less star power. And the best teams...
Hold on.
I'm finishing a point here. I'm allowed. Also, the best teams don't hoard the best players like they used to. And that's if you want to even go back further... The 11.7 has definitely leveled that, and more teams try. 10 years ago, Coastal Carolina didn't have a great ballpark. They didn't have a great ballpark until 2 years ago. So their talent level is better. More and more teams try now. There's less of a concentration. There's a lot more parity. There are a lot fewer really, really good teams. And that when you have a lot less separation between the teams, and then you take the bats into account where it's squeezed the teams together even more. There's extreme parity. That's good in a lot of ways. That does not necessarily mean the best foot gets put forward in the Caldwell series. I think the product of the Caldwell series, for a variety of reasons, is a lot worse than it used to be.
See, but what I would say, though, is when you say, like, there's more guys are signed in top 10 rounds. At the same time, what doesn't happen now is we used to have where it was like, high school guys going to college in the 22nd, the 24th, they're like, here's 250, here's 700, here's that. I do think that somewhat cancels out.
No, it doesn't. I've asked guys that.
I understand
for
you
six
ask
years,
guys, but also scouts generally, almost always, and I respect what's but it's easy to always think of it in the past looking better than it does now.
I'm not just asking, I've asked the coaches. The coaches all think they get less talent now because their bonuses are so much higher. If you have any desire to play pro ball, And you indicate that before you get drafted. You're going to get drafted and you're going to get signed. And it's a lot different if, especially with the signing deadline, if they could have gotten you on campus, for the most part, they got you to school. They got you in. You were fished in if you got to campus. But that doesn't happen now. If you have any indication you're going to get that pre-draft deal and that you're going to get that bonus, you know what you're going to get, and you sign. The college coaches and the scouts agree on that one. Less talent gets through now than got through the draft before this system. That's a consensus opinion in the industry.
I'm not saying that may not be true. I am saying, though, that the reality is, as you said, more parity, I think, actually adds to it.
It adds to the first two weekends. Absolutely. It makes regionals wackier. It makes super regionals better. I'm not arguing the college baseball product. I'm arguing the College World Series product. I think both are down, but the College World Series product is much more down because the ballpark and the bats combined make for so much less offense. When you had 9 home runs hit this year, 15 last year, 3 each of the 2 years before that. So the flat seam ball has helped, but baseball is meant to be played with home runs. We have 80-some years of empirical evidence of this, that baseball with home runs is better than baseball without home runs.
We have baseball home runs until we get to Omaha.
We have some, but again, 50% of the home runs went out of the game. 50% of the offense went out of the game. I do agree that it's more in balance. I don't agree. So what is the identity of college baseball right now? To the average fan, a Major League Baseball fan who checks in on college baseball, what do they think of first? Bunts.
Yes, absolutely.
And that is not what they thought of 6-7 years ago. They thought of offense. They thought of... my argument has been consistently, yes, the game was very offensive. It was less offensive in 2010 than it was in 1998. Now, it had crept up because of the bat rolling. But it was still less than it was in 1998. The fact that it was getting closer to 98 levels was bad. Right about 2005, 6, 7, 8, right in that meat. I wasn't the beat writer. I'm not being nostalgic. I'm just saying in that mid-2000s, they had the bats right. And it was an offensive sport, but it was down from what its peak had been. And I thought college baseball worked better with an offensive identity. And the players, as I always say, are amateurs, and they need the help. The whole industry of baseball, there's more help for defense, pitching's better, there's more information for the players, but there's not as much work put in. It's the consensus of the coaches I've talked to. Offensive approaches among amateurs stink. I've heard this for so long. Even on the international side, like the Japanese have better hitting approaches than us, Koreans have better hitting approaches than us. This is what Eric Campbell and USA coaches have said for years. So it's writ large in Omaha, where if you don't have a consistent approach and you don't play consistent defense, it killed Arizona today. One bad play by Cody Raymer, he made 2 errors in the play, cost them 2 runs, and all 4 runs were unearned. I mean, you cannot hit your way out of those mistakes anymore. And I don't think it's the best product. I don't think there's any way that you could say that college baseball puts its best foot forward in the current College World Series. In TD Ameritrade Park, these bats, all those factors. For me, the college baseball product overall is a little bit less, but in the College World Series, it's significantly worse. It's a lesser event than it used to be, and that pains me. But I've talked to a lot of people in college and professional baseball about that who agree with me. That doesn't mean I'm right. It just makes me feel very confident in viewing the game the way that I view it.
And you're talking about American hitting approaches being kind of one-dimensional at this point. It reminds me of, I think it was 2 years ago when I went to Instruct, and they brought, I think it was the Indians Instructs team against one of the Japanese, or the Taiwanese teams.
NC Dinos?
Yes.
That's Korea.
The Korean team, I'm sorry. And they got one hit because they had never seen and never had to deal with anything other than amateur level pitching. It was pitching backwards the whole game, and none of these kids knew how to adapt. And so that's what it was, almost a perfect game.
And lack of adjustments. I mean, you know, Andrew Beckwith is the most outstanding player, and that's fantastic. I'm happy for @CapAndDash. Great Twitter handle, great college pitcher. I mean, he's not the first pitcher who's dominated in Omaha, throwing 87 miles, topping out at 87. But it is amazing that 3 teams that are full of good players could not adjust to Andrew Beckwith. Just couldn't adjust. And the frustration in Florida's coach, Brad Weitzel's voice, talking about Florida's inability to adjust to Andrew Beckwith, was, we told them what to do. And he, one of the phrases he says, we tell them, get that foot at the front of the batter's box, beat the sink. And the guy goes in there to the batter's box, and like he every like he does for 230 other bats, the first thing he does is plant his back foot at the back of the box. And we're screaming at him from the dugout, we just told you, get the front. But routine takes over, and I, you know, and that's for young players. So I think you used to hear about the aluminum bat swing that scouts used to talk about. That wasn't a myth. That was true. And you still, now it's the approach that you hear people talk about, scouts, when guys transition to pro ball, not the and not necessarily the swing. You still you hear still about the swing, but it's not as pronounced as it used to be. So that's my takeaway from the Cobble series. The other part of the takeaway is bitching about that takes away, detracts from what Coastal accomplished. Really what I wanted to ask you guys about is, like, where, you know, for you, where Coastal ranks on baseball upsets. I mean, is there even a major league analog? I mean, is this like the, because it's not like the Twins going worst to first. I mean, is it like the Mets in 1969? I mean, I'm trying to think of what the analog is. Because they've been good for a long time, but their first College World Series, and they win it. That has not happened since Minnesota in 1956.
Right. It's going in their first one and winning it, and the reality that Coastal...
And that they're a Big South program.
Right.
A team that in May, when they went out of conference in a weekend series at Georgia Tech, not even a middle-of-the-road ACC program, they got swept at Georgia Tech.
This isn't only their first baseball championship. This is their first championship in any sport.
Right, but baseball clearly is the
baseball is
the
their
sport.
Their,
right.
That's their carrying card. But I do at the same time think this is not like the 60. This is not even like the 60-down Mets, though, in that this is a team that's been consistently good that
right.
now has broken through into greatness. Because if you win a national title, you're a great team. That's, I mean, you play
no
to win
question.
The game.
Hey, they were number 15 coming into the and into the postseason.
They were ranked
rankings,
in our preseason top 25.
Ranked 23rd preseason. They've been to Super Regionals in the past. This is not,
this
it
is
was
not,
not
a team
new
that
they're good.
This
That's
is not a
new.
Team that cracked into the top 25 this year for the first time in Baseball America poll history. This
right.
is someone who,
and it's
we
not
talk
like,
about Coastal on a regular basis.
They're not even years. Like Fresno. Like they're analogous to Fresno in that Fresno was number 18 in our preseason rankings in 2008. But Fresno had been to the College Series three times before. They had plenty of big leaguers, established big leaguers, guys who've been stars, guys who you think of with Fresno State, where Fresno State had gotten to a certain level in college baseball. Honestly, Fresno State as a program prior to 2008 is pretty analogous to Long Beach State. Produced a lot of big leaguers, a lot of tradition, three or four trips to Omaha. Very analogous. Coastal Carolina wasn't at even that level. They were a notch below, but not have no Omaha on their background. They're a notch below. Will Lingo and I kind of think that they're really basically an East Coast Cal State Fullerton kind of program, post-World War II program at the beach, not a lofty academic school, and not in a big conference, like in the shadow. You know, they're in the Big West, shadow of the Pac-12. Coastal's in the shadow of the ACC and SEC. But Coastal, it doesn't have four championships like Fullerton, but I guess give them time. They've got one. They're on their way, which it's really, from that standpoint, it's an incredible accomplishment. And the fact that Gary Gilmore is the guy who started it and the guy who finishes it, that he starts
That's
the
awesome.
Program at the Division I level, he starts building it up. Because they were NAIA when Mickey Brantley played there back in the day. But he's the one who starts the Division I and wins a championship like that for 21 years. It's incredible. I just remember the first day of the series out there, the media commenting on how unpolished he was media-wise. He was there long enough to get some polish. He was there for 2-plus weeks. That was a long stint.
He's got the cliches down now.
I think he does, and hey, they watch Bull Durham every bus trip, so... you didn't read that part?
No,
yeah,
every
so that's that was the surprising part. I thought he would know the win one for the just here to do my best and help the team and that kind of thing. Some days you win, some days you lose. Some days when you're getting ready to play for the national championship, it rains or it just has lightning every 30 minutes in the 8 mile radius. So kudos to our guys Ted Cahill and Michael Anna for lasting the entire couple of weeks. Thanks you guys. I've got another part of the podcast here coming up with Murray Cook of MLB previewing the game this weekend at Fort Bragg Stadium as the Marlins take on the Braves. First Major League Baseball game ever in a military installation, and the first one also ever in the state of North Carolina. So stay tuned for that. Thanks, JJ and Josh. And here comes Murray Cook. It's an impressive tour, Murray, for sure. It's a fantastic tour. I guess I should actually do an introduction. Murray Kirk, what is your official title with MLB, Murray?
With Major League Baseball, I'm their official field consultant.
Official field consultant. So that's gone back. Your first experience, as you wrote on your blog, was 1989, that you've been involved in some way, shape, or fashion. But really, for me, the first time I became aware of your involvement was in 2000 in Sydney, Australia.
Right, right.
So as I've really followed your career, it's really been your involvement in basically being kind of the troubleshooter, the person who goes in mm-hmm. and makes sure that a playing field for any event, whether it's minor league baseball, international baseball, major league game in this case here mm-hmm. at Fort Bragg, mm-hmm. that the field is up to the standards that Major League Baseball wants it to be. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You've had some really huge challenges, but I imagine that over that 16-year span, going back to Sydney, just how much has the technology changed in your field? I mean, everyone in our lives have all been touched by technology.
Sure. Sure.
The digital revolution, these kind of things, information revolution. How has just groundskeeping and that industry that you're in and field maintenance and preparation been, has it been revolutionized or has it just been a slow evolution with technology on your side?
You know, it's been an evolution, especially probably from late 80s, early 90s when we started seeing a lot of the information come out of the golf course industry.
Okay.
Started as far as field construction and materials. See, there wasn't even a degree to be a head groundskeeper of a baseball field
right.
back in the 80s and 90s, right? You could go to school and learn about soils, be a soil scientist, or you can go be a greenskeeper.
Right.
But there was nothing for baseball field management or sports field management. And in the past 15 years, now there has been. Hmm. So the biggest thing is education. The development of the Sport Turf Managers Association, the STMA, mm-hmm. who now most head groundskeepers are sport turf managers.
Right.
You can become a certified sports field manager now. You can become certified to do this type of work.
So since the days of Caddyshack, where we all think of the word groundskeeper,
yeah.
it's come around a little bit since
education
since Bill
has led us. So okay. with the education piece, well, then there's the I've got to have a ballpark that I can play on 300 days out of the year, or maybe
right.
365, depending
right.
if you're in Florida.
Right.
So the technology had to meet the demand, and the fields did. So we've seen advances in equipment from all the different vendors of Toros and Jacobsons and John Deere's just come building specific baseball field maintenance equipment, specifically only to the sport that weren't even around 10 years ago, 15 years ago for sure. And along with that, it's helped us, and not only the equipment, but the actual types of turf grass.
Right.
You know, back in those days, we couldn't even grow Bermuda grass north of Richmond, Virginia.
Wow.
And now you can grow Bermuda grass all the way up into Purdue.
Wow.
University.
Wow.
It's just the scientists have really created some wonderful products for us to move soil in and out and turf in and out.
So your last two big projects were here in Fort Bragg, where you basically took a field of weeds and have turned it into a minor league, basically a ballpark that's like a triple-A size ballpark, essentially, that's going to house a one-time Major League Baseball game, a regular season game. And then your previous big project was Cuba, right? It was in Havana.
Right.
At Stadio, at one of the most famous ballparks in the world, Stadio yeah. Latin Americano.
Yeah.
Which was a bigger challenge? I got to imagine it was Cuba.
You know, Cuba was big just because of the obviously because of the president and so on, all the other political components, but, you know, working in Cuba, I mean, it became, you know, that whole trip was diplomatic, not only from the other part, but down to the field part. How
right.
do we work together to make this field better for both teams? And it was, we learned a lot about the people there. We learned so much because I was with them every day for a month, and what some of their hardships and some of the things they go through, and they can't find glasses, and they can't find, you know, things that they really needed. It was
sounded like they couldn't find shovels.
We couldn't find anything. So we had to ship a bunch of stuff over, and it was like Christmas. I mean, I had guys crying, and they saw me pull out this edger and edge the field with it, because the guy had been edging with a machete his entire life.
Oh my gosh!
I mean, so you go from just the simpleness of just, you know, you take things so much for granted at these ballparks we have today, and how we had and what we had there to use was just so limited. But, you know, those experiences make us stronger as Americans, make us stronger as a people, and, you know. make us all better for everybody.
Because really, I mean, you hear the stories, and we saw it during that event of the 1950s automobiles, but they were basically groundskeeping like the 1950s, I assume, as well.
Exactly. Everything, we went to see a sod farm there north of the city, and they came out with these pieces of sod that were probably, you know, I said, are you going to cut them big? Yeah. They brought the sod to the field, and they were in 6-inch by 6-inch pieces. So that's what we started with.
I saw the picture on your blog, like just hand by hand.
Hand by hand, putting pieces in. We had 3 or 4 weeks to grow it in, and we got it smooth and safe, and that was the goal. To get it smooth and safe, obviously, for the playability. But this, you know, again, living there, being part of that project, I was there when the Orioles were there in 1999.
Yeah.
And similar, it was neat. It was neat. And there, and again, in 05,
right?
Was it 07 for the Olympic qualifier?
Yeah.
Where both Cuba and USA made it, and they still played the final game, probably the most exciting game I've ever seen in my life.
Wasn't that like Kevin Slowey, I think, was the pitcher for Team USA? I seem to recall
David Johnson was the manager.
That's right.
Yeah, you had Rick Epstein. Was it Rick Epstein or which one?
I think Rick Epstein was on there.
Epstein was one of the guys. Raleigh was on there. Just the coaching staff. And they already made it, but that final game was just one of those things. To see it in that ballpark, 50,000 people, jam-packed, amazing. Then you go, 10 years later, 8 years, 9 years later, and we're back there with another major league game.
And the stadium hadn't changed very much, I'm going to guess, unfortunately.
Zero.
It's a shame, because it's a 55,000 seat stadium. I mean, it was the Yankee Stadium of Latin America.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. The largest stadium in all of Latin America, baseball stadium.
I mean, it's because it's supposed to be a magnificent structure, but then you look at the pictures and you see the roof falling apart. I mean,
you know, this last event, we were able to upgrade the field, leaving a lot of equipment.
Great.
Through the tools and equipment, materials, supplies, and so on. They got half the roof repaired. They have new locker rooms. They got better dugouts. So we left an impact there that obviously will still be there, you know, hopefully, you know, years to come. And, you know, they've asked me to come back and do clinics and, you know, at their other fields. They got some other, the ballpark in Santiago is really nice.
And I understand that and that's one of the things that I hear the commissioners say. I've heard the guys from Baseball Canada say that, you know, as these political changes are happening in Cuba, you just hope that we can maintain that baseball infrastructure, because it's such a baseball country.
Right.
You want to try to do what we can to maintain that infrastructure. And you were part of that, which I just think is commendable and also pretty neat that you were able to be part of that.
Well, it's always good to do to get out and reach out to people. And I've been blessed with that, with this, well, my role.
And this will be, again, a totally different situation. Yeah. And it sounds like this is possibly a prototype, because I guess the biggest challenge of this, right, was the condensed time frame and the fact that you were doing something that had never been done. Build a major league stadium from scratch in 4 months. Go.
Yeah. Hello. Here we go. Here's a shovel.
That's it.
You can take the one from Cuba and bring it here and start.
That's right. Was that the biggest part of the challenge, just the newness
much.
Of it?
Yeah, the newness and getting the you know, getting the approvals, you know, obviously with you know, and the guys here, the base people we've been working with, you know, have been just phenomenal. They really had to, a lot of red tape to actually, you know, to accept the donation,
right,
to actually be able to start the project. So, you know, took us a while to get that check to say, okay, we have a green light, we can accept your gift.
Right.
So.
Gift from Major League Baseball and the Players Union, which is the other really amazing thing of this. And something,
the combination.
An unbelievable, again, an unprecedented gesture, really, by Major League Baseball, by any
and the Players Association,
sports,
exactly right.
I can't think of anything that's similar between the union and management getting together and doing a gift for the U.S. military like this.
Right, right. And we talked about it. We said, okay, where's places around? And, of course, this place came up. I mean, 200,000 people, 50,000 people on the base. You know, all the numbers are there for having and the reason was there. And the date was there. And the July 3rd, July 4th weekend, It just all matches up nice. This the ballpark in itself is starting there and finally started in March to clear the site, because when we came and looked at it, they showed us 2 or 3 different sites around the area.
Right.
And we looked at one. We looked at, there was one over near Womack, a baseball field, but it's just none of space.
Okay.
This site is on their master plan. The actual old Willow Creek Golf Course.
Okay.
Which has been abandoned for about 6 years.
Sure, okay.
It was just overgrown.
Because this is on the Air Force base. That is now the Army airfield.
Correct.
So that's probably why it got abandoned, I would imagine.
Correct. If you walk down this path over here where the fans will be coming in after this is over and walk down, you'll see there's some old vintage planes down here where people will walk by those and see those when they come in now.
Oh, our J.J. Cooper at Baseball America is a huge buff of those things, and he will be overjoyed to see those.
He's gonna freak out when you walk up from that area, from the fan side there, and the fans enter from both corners. So they don't come from back here. They come from both corners of the field. They come in. So when they come up, you'll see openings in the left field and right field areas where Populous did an outstanding job doing these little tweaking designs. And again, Populous is Populous and BAM, BAAM, are the engineers of the seating bowl and the structure of how it all came together in the tents. And they just did just a fabulous job developing all the different components. Again, taking this and taking that. You know, Joe G is like, okay, let's move this over here, let's move this over. It's like an erector set, but, you know, we're kind of piecing things together. And, you know, Phil Bradley got involved with a little bit of the Player Association, how your locker rooms go here. No, let's move the bathrooms on this side. Let's put those over here. Just a lot of that, you know, sharing information. It was a great dialogue between the whole team.
And those are all people who've been just a part of this for all the time that you've been working. I mean, I think Phil Bradley was in, I'm pretty sure I saw him in Sydney. If it was, I know Tony Bernazar was there with the Union at that time.
Yes, he was.
I think Phil was there too. If it wasn't there, it was soon after.
He was with us in Sydney.
And Joe G has been around that all this time when he wasn't a general manager, straight into
it. Just a wealth of information about how this is set up. And I mean, I was with Phil in Cuba when we got a call. We had a conference call from Cuba to hear about the locker rooms and how to set them up. So I was on my phone, they were on the computer here, Papa's was in Kansas City, and we were working through the locker rooms here trying to figure them out as from Cuba.
The logistics of these things is what we don't think about, but that's what you want, right? You want people to show up and just imagine this just happened.
Right.
You know, that it looks effortless when it's not. I mean, that's really the goal though, right?
It is. I mean, it's such a great thing. We call it the field of thanks.
Yeah, that's right.
Because that's really what it is.
Yeah,
it's like
it is.
Field of dreams. And you look down the line, you see these areas, these large areas on the
the
black areas. That's all for ADA.
Oh, wow.
This whole section down here, the lower two sections here, the top seats on the whole building, those are ADA seats.
And so crucial for military.
Yes.
I hadn't even thought about that.
Yeah, huge. The best seats in the house, here and here.
That almost makes me weep because it's just amazing. Because you go around when you're in this community, you see the toll of war.
Yeah.
You see it.
You do.
And you see the amputees and...
It's really... Yeah, you see them. And that's, you know what? I'm with you. So we made you can tell we made some larger... our backstop net. It's just not here. It goes down.
Right.
Angles down above the dugout to protect people there. Because, you know, people here haven't been to a baseball game.
Right.
So you got more protection. And then down the ADA section, you'll see the poles a little higher above the fence.
I do.
That's another 6 foot of... There'll be a net in front of that. So sit behind there, if a ball gets in line, you know, it's not going to hurt. So those are things, again. Little details that, you know, we wanted to make sure that we protect the fans, protect the people. And
if you just dream that doesn't happen. That takes attention to detail of those things that
you're
talking about.
Someone looking at them and saying, what do you think about this? Well, who's going to sit there? Well, what's... And Joe's like, oh, we got to pad that. Well, we got to fill that. We got to pad that pole. No, we got to fix this pole. We got to, you know.
So. And then you have the artificial berm, which is the new one for me. It sounds like a new one for you.
Yeah, okay.
Oh my gosh, that's like a C-130.
a little flyby.
It's a very active Army airfield.
It is literally half a mile that way, the base is.
So they're going to be flyover. And obviously, we had it as we walked in today. The two Army pilots who basically fought for this assignment to do the flyover, which is awesome.
Yeah, we're going to have them come up out of center field and come over the center. It's going to be pretty cool.
So we have artificial berms. So, you know, this is a podcast I've kind of recorded, but how do you kind of even describe, like, basically it's like a putt-putt golf course on risers almost. And, you know, putt-putt was invented in Fayetteville.
Is that right?
It was. I'm a font of Fayetteville trivia, so it's apropos that you have the fake greens out there.
Oh,
what you need is a windmill to shoot through.
Funny. I didn't know that. That's hilarious.
But I mean, that sounds like that was a unique feature for this as well. There's going to be a video board in left field, and major league dugouts. And it sounds like you've also had just great feedback from the Braves and the Marlins players and officials.
Tremendous.
That they're eagerly anticipating this opportunity.
Cannot wait to get here. The players, it's kind of like, hey, it's on its way. It's on our way to our next State Stadium. It's a stop over here. They are, you know, yeah, all I've heard is positives.
Great.
And from the people coming into the base, you know, I've been here now for a couple of weeks living in a hotel, and a lot of people, obviously, you know, that just come up, you know, they hear the, you know, where, you know, they start talking. Everyone's very talkative.
Right.
It's a very friendly town.
Yeah, it is.
And the service members are like, how are you, sir? I'm
right.
Good, sir. So, what are you doing here today? I'm like, well, I'm with baseball. Oh, are you really? Give me tickets.
Exactly. You probably didn't get very much of that in Sydney.
No,
a little different vibe on the international side.
Yeah, that was another big event. We talk about big events. That opening day in Sydney for turning the cricket field into a...
cricket field into a baseball stadium. And the first game was, and I covered that. That was Daisuke Matsuzaka for Japan against Ben Sheets for the United States. First game anyway with the United States involved.
Right.
Which was a great tournament. I mean, it really... And so I guess that's a good transition into the international side. I mean... So you've been Sydney, you've been Beijing, I assume Panama. You were mentioning Panama. Crazy story from Panama. that's a crazy story. A tragic story, but tragic. I've always told the story of my own personal Greek tragedy if I didn't get a free trip to Athens for the 2004 Olympics because the U.S. lost in the qualifier to Mexico to Rigo Beltran and Sanchez, the first baseman at that home run. And Frank Robinson having Joe Mauer sacrifice bunt. I'm not bitter about that at all. But I mean, but what are some of the? I mean, are the biggest challenges internationally just cutting through some of those again? That red tape of trying to work with all these different locales, or after a while, do you walk in and say, "I'm Murray Kirk, Major League Baseball"? And now they know you.
Is there
a little credibility now?
Absolutely, especially throughout Latin America.
Good.
Mexico. Look at Mexico in the past. Since 2012, they've built 5 or 6 new stadiums, $30 million stadiums.
Wow. I was not aware of that.
Huge. They're in Hermosillo, Culiacan, Obregon, Mazatlan, Guadalajara.
Oh, fantastic. I did not know that.
All new stadiums.
So kind new, of a revolution large. Almost.
It's like minor league baseball hit Mexico
20 years afterwards,
4 or 5 years ago.
Okay.
And here everyone's built new stadiums. New stadium in Managua, new stadium in Barranquilla, Colombia, new stadium. I mean, Managua's building a 15,000-seat stadium.
I did not know that.
They are, throughout South America, Latin America, the game, they're just doing so much. And then, you know, over Asia, the same thing. I'm talking to guys over there in Taiwan and Japan doing a lot of things. Taiwan's building big complexes of training centers.
So in your experience, really, it has been, I mean, this is a post-Olympic baseball. I know there's a chance it could get back in for 2020. I think they probably expected to be back, at least in Japan.
Yeah, yeah.
But after baseball left the Olympics, it sounds like through the Classic and these qualifiers, the game is still growing internationally and maybe even faster.
I would say so. I would say just the growth of the game throughout baseball-related countries, even the DR. And So the Dominican Republic, you know, the Winter Leagues, we do all the evaluations in all the Winter League ballparks.
Okay.
We shouldn't be. Your
crib standings,
Winter League standards, because a lot of players go to play. And wherever MLB plays, wherever International Baseball Federation plays, the World Baseball Soccer Congress plays, they in some of their main tournaments, like for example the European Championship, are coming up in September in Holland. We go and we evaluate those ballparks to ensure that they meet the minimum requirements.
Right.
They're safe. That's
right.
That's pretty
player
safe.
Safety is your number
that's
one
it.
Factor.
So we go check the dugouts, the field, the dugout, whatever, and make recommendations. Here's got to fix this, and okay, the players can go play. So that's kind of the part that we really get tied into as far as helping grow the game. With that comes education.
Right.
So you look at the Dominican Republic 10 years ago, and now. You look at all their Winter League clubs. The ballparks are looking so much better. The fields are. They look forward to us coming back doing more clinics. Then I have all those academies they built in the DR.
Well, you just think about it. If you're just talking about the United States, really just in the last 10 years, getting to a point where there are educational courses specifically for field turf management.
Correct.
And my wife works at NC State University.
Correct.
They have that a program
Correct.
There.
Correct.
So if that's just in the last decade to 15 years in the U.S., it's probably not in the Netherlands
Even,
or in Europe or in Latin America.
Exactly. Now, you have great soccer pitches.
Right.
In Europe.
They're practiced at that.
You got great rugby pitches and cricket pitches in Sydney and Australia, right? So you've got that practice, which was great because in Sydney, when we did the field there, we did that transition in 18 days, 21, 21 wow. days. 21 days we took turned the cricket pitch into the baseball field.
I remember in Sydney, there were not very many bad hops.
No.
And you also had that crazy semifinal game with the biggest rainstorm ever. Remember the home plate umpire?
Oh, my gosh.
The first base umpire comes down the line like, hey, come on, we got to call this. And the home plate umpire is like, yeah. call it and shoving him back. No.
Yeah, no, no.
Go
no.
back, and the lightning is going berserk.
That was Korea.
That was unbelievable. It was U.S.-Korea, right?
U.S.-Korea.
And as soon as they came back, Korea. Interference at the yeah. plate or whatever, yeah. Brent Abernathy, I think.
13th inning or something, 11th inning finally, bam. Home run.
Yeah, Doug Minkiewicz. He pimped the heck out of it, too. Good for
we went.
Good for iChart.
Thank God.
Yeah, that was a long game.
Well, we didn't have a choice. We had to win that one.
They did have to win that one, and and that was right after Gookie Dawkins got picked off at first base.
Yeah.
So he gets picked off after iChart was supposed to sack bunt, and then I think it was the next or second next pitch was a home run of Roy Oswalt, a big hero of that. Then
right.
you were there for 2004 Athens.
Yeah.
And not a lot of Greek experience with baseball, I would imagine. Field there was wasn't it?
Oh, exactly. To we built the three baseball fields and the three softball fields
okay.
for them. And what a beautiful facility. You know, I was just there like literally last year whenever for holidays, because I lived there in Greece for like 6 months.
Oh, wow.
And my
your Greek was not bad?
And my family, yeah.
Kalinikasu and Endaxi. Your Greek's all right.
My Greek's all right.
So you were there for a while. So you were familiar with the area, but building the baseball stadium was all new. It was Greek to them.
Yeah, it was Greek to them, literally. They had no clue about building baseball fields, but we enjoyed doing that. It was fun during the summer. It was also the Euro Cup year that year.
Oh, okay.
Which is a big event.
And I help recruit players for the Greek national team now, so I think they're in Euro Cup in 2016.
Well, they need your help. I don't know if you saw Tom Mazeroski's.
I haven't seen his
Tom is looking hard for funding.
Okay.
So he is. He's created a page to get funding to help pay for the trip.
Unless I hit the wrong button, I was supposed to put $100 in there. So
right.
I'm always helping recruit players for them. I saw last year's spring training. There's a kid named Mitch Kellogg was pitching for the Tigers on this backfield.
Right.
I'm looking them up on the Baseball America site, and I say, oh, wait a minute. Born Athens, Greece. When he comes out of the game, I say, hey, can I talk to you? Are you free to talk?
Really?
I recruited him right there for the team. So
one of the things we did.
They need players, but they need funding.
MLB, and it never came out in the news, but it was really special because at the 04 Olympics, at the Olympics were over, we bought equipment, cages, screens, batting tops, field mate, mowers, carts, tarps, all kinds of stuff for this stuff. They put it in storage. Baseballs. Hundreds of dozens of baseballs. They put it on storage. And I was like, okay, year went by, and third of them is going, down. So what's going on with this stuff? I talked to Tom. They finally got a storage. They finally released it to the local federation.
Oh, okay.
They had that transition
sure.
between
yep.
ownership. That took place about 2 or 3 years later.
Okay.
So for the 2012 Olympic qualifier,
okay.
the Greek team needed funding to go up to play in the tournament. I think it was in holiday.
Too. Yeah, there was because that 20. Do you mean like the 2011 World
2011
Cup?
World Cup
that was in Panama because they qualified for that. So 2010
exactly.
qualifier was in the Netherlands.
So they needed to get funding. I said, look, we need equipment for the German Regensburg
right
there, and we need equipment in Italy. Let me come in. We'll evaluate the equipment you have in Athens. MLB will buy it. We'll sell it to these guys. Funding goes back to you guys. You have money.
Wow.
So we actually the equipment we use in 04. Half of it we sold. We got enough money to send those guys. It was
to 2010. Wow, how about that?
MLB put all that together. It was one of those things that kind of under the rug, but it was such a great thing for the Greek Federation to be able to play the tournament. And it worked because it helped everybody else. Other equipment did. And, there were still tarps on a big pallet.
Wow.
Never even opened.
This is what the commissioner says. This is what the commissioner says. All their studies say, the longer you play, the longer you're going to be a fan.
Yeah.
Well, even just for those guys, they play. And they're going to remember that.
Yeah.
And hopefully their family, their friends remembers
that.
You've
got to be able to play.
That's the one of the things I respect the most about Commissioner Manfred is that he really does seem to have his eye on this, on the grassroots of the game. I think Commissioner Steele was very forward-thinking when it came to the international side, though. I don't think I don't think he gets his due on the international side of just how international the game has become, sure. And not just Latin American, but the whole rest of the world. I guess Europe's kind of this next step, or that baseball's kind of dipping its toe in. Is that in the plans and the works, or is it still a distant idea of a major league, with a game like this, where you would plop into the Netherlands and play, or London, those kind of things? Is that possible?
Is it possible? Sure. Is it on the MLB playbook? Again, that's one of those playbooks that that's closed by a key and door up there,
right.
Especially this time of year during the collective bargaining unit.
Sydney 2014 or 15 opening day?
14. 14 opening day. It was tough to pull that one off because of that transition. So,
and timing.
In 2000, we played in Homebush
Stadium.
And then in 2014, we played
Sydney Cricket Grounds.
Yes, Sydney Cricket Grounds. So those are two separate events. Two different places, and the work that was done there was a hard one too. That was pretty hard too.
They were probably a little bit more protective about that one. That's like their Yankee Stadium for cricket.
Oh, tell me about it. But the guy there, Tommy Parker, the head guy there, the greensman, super guy. I'll never forget. He and I sitting at the rain war room, we called it, was right behind home plate. And Bud Selig, commissioner, comes in and he sits down beside us because we're looking at the computer. Mm-hmm. We're all looking at the computer because we're talking about the rain that was getting real.
And the commissioner can work blue from time to time.
And he's like, you know, I consider myself a novice.
I've heard this. I've heard about this. The 2008 World Series, I heard about that.
So tell me, when's it going to update? He said, about 2 minutes. Well, you know, in Milwaukee, he gives him a story about, you know, something else. And it was just great. And just like the day before, Tom says, I hope I get a chance to meet the commissioner. I hope I get just to meet him. I said, you might.
Yeah. He didn't just meet him. He got to just like chit chat with him.
They're holding no elbows. And
fantastic.
It was great. You know, everyone's around there. But so they, we're like looking at them and the updates, and there's nothing behind it was like breaking up. He looked over at Murray, what do you think? I says, I think we're over. I think it's over.
Yeah.
What do you think, Tom?
Sure.
Yeah, the commissioner said, you know, the comp says, commissioner, I don't think we should be able to play at all. Let's play. And away we go.
That's fantastic.
And the commissioner says, that's it. How long will it take Kershaw to get ready?
That's fantastic. Yeah, not an unimportant part of it is that the best pitcher in the game.
Just like that, you know.
Warming up
it was
there.
Just a great exchange of information from some people there, and away we go.
But ultimately, that's really what you're charged with, is making sure that the Kershaws, the Freddie Freemans, the Jose Fernandezes, the Giancarlo Stantons can play and put on their show. And like we were talking off air.
Yeah.
But it really ultimately is about the players and making it look like it's just a regular major league game anywhere, right?
Right. It always comes back to safety. You know, consistency and playability. And these guys are in the middle of the season now. You know, we've played many, many during season games. We're opened up the Tokyo Dome,
yeah.
I don't know how many times. We played down in Puerto Rico, 50 times, I think, over the past 10 years. All those games, the Expos.
Oh, exactly, yeah. All those Expos games.
All the Expos games for 25 games each year.
I'd imagine Stade Olympique for those exhibition games. That seems like that's one of your bigger challenges.
Yep,
you tweeted that picture of the broken down mound.
I mean, that didn't look like
a baseball stadium.
Alamo Dome and those events. Of course, the exhibition games in Mexico City this year. It's a very, very hectic year for baseball. Internationally.
You're too good at your job. The more you succeed at it, the more they want you to go do.
Well, we'll see. We just, you know, you're excited. They have faith in you. But, you know, the Commissioner Manfred is, having known him before being a commissioner, he's just so good about he's good.
Yeah.
He's just good.
There's a high level of competence that comes from him. Doesn't mean people don't make mistakes, but
he gets it. And as far as international piece, it's the play ball program, all that. It just, you know, really getting into the details.
I can't, as a North Carolinian, I just can't, I'm so proud of this. I mean, the state has so much baseball heritage. I mean, Fayetteville is supposedly where Babe Ruth hit a professional home run. That's one of the old stories they tell there.
Right.
But it has such a history of minor league and amateur baseball, and now with, you know, we're a tiny part of it at Baseball America, but having been here for 35 years now.
Sure. Miles Wolf boys.
That's right. But USA Baseball being here since 2003 now.
Very familiar with that.
You know, so we it's a governing body of baseball in this country on the amateur level.
Sure. Help
so out. This is a, yeah.
Help to build that. Help
yeah.
Paul build that.
Oh, that complex is incredible.
Turned out nice.
I'll tell you what, there was a home run derby there the other day with the 18U and the 12U kids doing a home run derby. That's a tough place to hit a home run.
Yes, it is.
That's a tough ballpark. It's not as tough as TD Ameritrade in Omaha, but it's a tough place to hit a home run. Not as tough as Omaha.
I'm looking forward to seeing how this one plays because the wind comes across. So we got our storms from here.
This is going to ask you, yeah.
So we're going to have a it's orientated in the
third base to first base breeze. Is what you're saying,
absolutely.
All right?
Absolutely. So you got that prevalent pretty much most of the day. I mean, that's where it comes across. So we got our due north right up the third baseline. So
okay.
it is dialed in.
So easterly breezes,
yes.
East by southeast breezes are going to come through.
So we'll
here.
See. We'll see how she plays in the evenings.
I'm excited to see how it plays. I'm very excited to have this interview actually happen. Actually write this column, put this online with it.
Great.
Murray, it's a pleasure. Right. So glad to actually get to meet you in person.
Same here.
This has been fun.
This concludes our program. Want more in-depth baseball coverage? Be a better fan. Visit BaseballAmerica.com to get more comprehensive baseball coverage.